I can remember turning a microphone on. Yes. 24:10. Did I ever actually say the verse? I think I just said 24. So let me read that when you get there. 24:10.
If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small.
All right. Mine says if you were slack in the day of distress. What's the idea here? What does it mean, the day of distress? Yeah, when things get hard, when it's difficult, and you've spent time preparing for, to use some male athletic terminology, or just male terminology or female for that matter as well, like the game day, right? You put all your training in, you've been in the weight room, you've lifted, you run, you're in shape, and everything you've done in preparation is for game day. But what happens when game day hits and you don't perform? Does it matter how much you can lift? Does it matter how fast you can run a 40? Does it matter how many drills you put in? How much time you spent preparing? If you can't do what matters when it matters, it really doesn't matter how strong you are. That's the idea here, right? Your strength is ultimately limited, right? We need to be men and women that in the midst of distress, when it matters, that we can perform. What does that look like in a spiritual realm? This is obviously, there's a physical side to this, but in the spiritual side of life, what is a day of adversity or things like that?
Persecution.
Yeah, maybe days when we're persecuted and have to step up and defend our faith. I guess ever imagine being in those situations where you've got to confess Christ or feel some sort of adversity for it and deny your faith and safety. I wonder how I'd perform in those situations. You see people that on the extreme end have been held at gunpoint, to say, confess Christ or deny Christ or die. Like, I don't know how I would do in that situation. So I really like my life. And obviously that's the most extreme example, but boy, there's times when it's scary to raise your hand in a classroom setting when people are barking about the Bible and how antiquated it is or whatever it is. I mean, I actually believe in that. I actually think that with this, I can remember times in University of North Texas and trying to defend my faith and just the fear of speaking in class in front of other people to let them know, man, I believe this. And I believe what this is saying is true. How about for other people in their days of distress? What does it look like for us to show up in other people's days of distress? What does that look like in your world when maybe somebody dies, a family member of a friend that you love? Maybe it's they're going through something difficult. They get bad news and a health deal. Someone gets fired and loses a job, right? What is our role as believers in those times to show up in other people's distress, right? We can talk about loving others or showing up or whatever it may be, but boy, if we're not there when it matters, it really doesn't matter. Okay, so think about that in your worlds and what situations God's put you in, both for you personally, your game day type situations when you've got to show up and you've got to represent and you've got to be who you are in the training that you put in, the Bible reading that you've done, the evangelism, the whatever it may be, and you've got to step up to the plate and play ball, or in other people's worlds when God is calling you to come alongside of someone else who's hurting or needs you, needs counsel, needs wisdom, needs support, needs you to sit with them on a couch and cry and just say, I'm sorry, and I don't have the words to fix this. I don't know why God did this. I don't know the answer, but I love you, and I'm here, and I'm going to be. That's showing up in the day of distress, right? Teddy Roosevelt was once asked, how can you be so brave? And he just said, I imitate brave men. I thought, man, that's a great quote. The idea being that, man, heroes and cowards are all the same. We all feel a great sense of fear in certain aspects of life when we're called to step out. The difference between a hero and a coward is not that one feels fear and one doesn't. It's one submits to fear and one chooses not to. Okay, so remember that. That was a great quote by a D-Day commander, one of the surviving commanders of D-Day. And as he was inspiring his men to go take the berm, to take the hill, he said, guys, there's two kind of people here, those that are dead and those that are going to be, and we got to go take that hill. Like, man, can you imagine that type of adversity and that type of difficulty to know that you're about to give your life for a cause that's far greater than you, and you're either dead or you're going to be, right? Very few people survive that day, and without it, it would have been a very different story. So many of us are probably not going to be in that drastic dire of a situation, but we're called to show up in little ways every day, okay? So remember that when you are face-to-face with fear, some people are going to choose to cower down and submit to it, and other people are going to push through it and deal with it and move on and show that their strength is not indeed limited, but is there when it counts, all right? Okie dokie. Thoughts on that? Say something so I can eat more donuts. All right, numbers. I think this is the first time I've eaten during residency. It's a whole new skill set I need to have. My wife says I'm good at talking with my mouth full, so I don't exercise good manners in our household. All right, so we are in Numbers, right? The chastening of God, the discipline of God. God is taking Israel basically behind the woodshed. We're going to see them get worked over a little bit. And this is going to be a rough season for them. Now, most of this is kind of a self-inflicted gunshot wound of sort. They're going to be dumb for the most part, not trust God, not trust Moses, and they're going to see the decisions that God is kind of forced to make based on their own disobedience. So this is a hard lot in life for them, if you will. Again, chapters 1 through 10 are all about the preparation of them getting ready to move with a couple little ditties in the midst of it that are instructional or what have you. But for the most part, God is simply giving them instructions on how to camp, how to move, and what they're going to do when they get there. Okay, we left off in chapter 4 talking about the priesthood. And I posed a question to you guys yesterday in regards to these two contrasting sets of numbers that we see, right? 4 verse 3 talks about if you're going to be a Levite, if you're going to be in the priesthood, you start at 30 and you finish at 50, right? And again, yesterday that sounded great. Today as a 40-year-old, not so much. In chapter 8, it says 25 to 50. What would you guys guess? Why would there be two different sets of numbers there? Yeah, Will.
You have like an apprenticeship for 5 years?
I think so. Can you imagine that? A 5-year discipleship / apprenticeship program for the new priest. Now, who would you guess would be doing that? Apprenticing. Who would be the discipler, if you will, in that situation? The priests, which one? The ones that have retired, right? Are they on the bench doing nothing, eating Oreos and watching Oprah all day? No, like they don't, they may not be on active duty, but what do you suppose their job is? Titus 2 women, right? Train up the next generation. Like older women pour into the younger women. Older men pour into the younger men. The 30 to 50 year olds, man, they're the ones that are in the game and getting after it. 50 year olds, you're on the bench, love you, mean it, right? So I'll be in 10 years. So Peggy, you're done. You just keep making donuts. You're doing a great job. And they would train. The idea would be the younger generation. What a fantastic view, right? We talk about the wisdom and the life experience that older folks have that you just can't replicate. You just can't. There's no way to teach that, right? There's no way to get that except just getting it through life. And then you got a 25, 26, 27-year-old young man hanging out with a seasoned veteran saying, you know what, here's what I learned. Let me tell you about the day that I saw Nadab and Abihu offer some sacrifices on an altar while they had one too many glasses of wine and got a little irreverent. You think those stories rung true from a generation that saw that and watched that? Let me tell you about the day we finished building this tent and I watched God himself in the form of a cloud descend upon the ark. It was magnificent, and 3 million people were there to observe that. You know, these generations, as they would move on, these would be stories that they would tell, but the older generation was not just encouraged to, but required to, in some degree, train up the up-and-coming priests, right? So as these stories would fade from memory, it was their job to kind of keep those alive and to remind these young men what their job was. 5 years is a pretty long apprenticeship program, yeah? Tells you the seriousness that maybe God would take this whole concept. Okay, so I think as best we can tell, that's probably what was going on. Okay, so back to chapter 4, kind of with that as our backdrop. Let me pray for us, and we will dive into the rest of the text and kind of get through some fun stuff in Numbers this morning. Lord, thanks for today. Thank you for your goodness to us. Thank you for your word, Lord. And as we see now, the distress that you are causing for the people and the tests that you are putting them through. And as we're seeing what's really on the inside of these men and women in the old generation come out. Lord, would you teach us through them? Would you help us not to be men and women that are characterized by qualities that we're going to see in this old generation, those of grumbling and bitterness and discontent and me-first type attitudes? Would you teach us, Father, from their errors and the things that they did that displeased you? And would we be men and women that are a great example to the generation coming up underneath us? Would we represent well Christ to all those that you put us around? And Father, would you just, again, teach us from your word? We're grateful for this time to study, that we have the freedom to come to a place like this and open your book, and as men and women seek to become more like Christ. Father, we love you and we thank you. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So as we move through chapter 4 now, we're going to see a little bit more of instructions from God as to how they're going to move, as we've talked about, and how they're going to move specifically the articles of the tabernacle, specifically the ark and all that other stuff. Okay. Yesterday we talked about the Kohathites, sons of Merari, the Merarites, and the, I still have no idea how you add an ites to that. So if y'all can figure that out, let me know how to say it, because I don't know how. And then the Girgashites, right? The Kohathites were the ones that got to touch like all the cool stuff, the ark, the instruments, the lampstand, and so forth. However, they weren't allowed to go in and mess with it originally, okay? Look at verse 5. When it was time to move, chapter 4, verse 5, this is how Aaron and his sons would have to prepare the articles, if you will.
Spread on top of that a cloth all of blue, and shall put it in its poles. And over the table of the bread of the presence, they shall spread a cloth of blue and put on.
All right, you see all these things listed. Sorry, Max, to cut you off, but everything has to get covered. So what do the priests, Aaron and his sons, have to do first before anybody can go in? They got to cover all this stuff. They're not allowed to see it. They're not allowed to touch it, right? By the way, it's funny. Max, your version says they cover it with goat skin. Anybody got a different translation?
Badger.
Sea cow. Porpoise. What the heck? Like, where do you get a porpoise in Israel, right? I don't know what the word is, but apparently they had a lot of difficulty translating it. So it's odd. So whatever it is, it's some type of very heavy like covering. It's not, you know, some light sheer fabric. It's heavy, it's beefy. The idea being that these things are covered not to be touched and not to be seen as well, okay? Every article in there, verse 7, you see the table of showbread, verse 9, the lampstand, verse 11, the golden altar, all these things had to be covered first. Then, verse 15, Aaron and his sons, when they have finished covering the holy objects of all the furnishings of the sanctuary, when the camp is to set out, after the sons of Kohath shall come in and carry them, so that they may not touch the holy objects and die. Don't touch them or you will die. Like, that's kind of a big deal, right? When you're playing a game at that level, like, don't accidentally oops and think you're threading that pole through the eyelid of the ark and accidentally trip and grab the ark, right? We'll see a story about that later on in the Samuels. That's a bad day. So they had to can be completely removed from that every time they did that, okay? So God is, again, serious about this. Again, these instructions are consistent, they are strong, and he's reminding them, don't mess around with how I do that, okay? Onward through chapter 4, you see more of the same. The Gershonites, the sons of Merari, and all the things that they have to do, they're numbered again, talking about their roles as they move. So more of the same that we've seen, but it's, again, the head priest, Aaron, and his two sons, Eleazar and Itamar, at this point now, that are having to do the work to cover those things, all right? Chapter 5 is an odd chapter, okay? I'll just mention that from up front, okay? This is based on their living situation, 3 million people in close quarters, constantly camping. God gives this rule in chapter 5 for, it looks like, this seasonal time. We don't see it applied later on. In fact, I don't think we ever see it applied in the Old Testament. But it's something to keep marriage relationships right, to snuff down jealousy and those sorts of things. That's kind of the picture of what we're getting, okay? So skip down to verse 11, and let's see kind of this new rule that God inserts, or new, for what it's whatever it's called, 11 and 12. Okay, stop there. So what's the situation, hypothetically? Yeah, so you've got a husband that suspects that his wife has been unfaithful. She wasn't caught in the act. There's no evidence, but he senses something is awry. Something's amiss with his wife. This is the potential situation. So I guess in this day and age, if she's had... He suspects she's had an affair. There was a way to get down to the bottom of that, okay? Here's what God does, okay? Verse 14, if a spirit of jealousy comes over him, this isn't a small thing. This isn't a, you know what, I'm just going to see, right? The idea is he's convicted. He feels like this has happened. She's been dishonest, untruthful, and now is going to go to the priest and say, listen, I need to know, okay? Here was the process. Verse 15, read that. So normally when a man would offer like a grain offering, there would be oils and other stuff that would be mixed into it. It was fragrant. It was those sorts of things. Now it's just barley. Okay. So some commentators have suggested barley is meal that you would feed to animals. This concept of a woman stepping outside the headship of her husband and having an affair with another man is an animal-like activity. It's degrading. It's debasing. So for anybody in that culture to step out the outside the bonds and the covenant of marriage is an animal-like act, and some have suggested that's why he presented this offering. But he would go to the priest with his wife and say, hey, you're being dishonest with me. There's something going on. I am now coming to the priest, and we're going to settle this matter once and for all before him. Okay? The priest in verse 16 would have her stand before him, before the Lord, and before everybody there. Take holy water, verse 17, in an earthenware vessel. Take some of the dust of the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. The priest can then have the woman stand before the Lord and let the hair of the woman's head go loose. Place the grain offering, of a memorial offering, in her hands, which is in the grain offering of jealousy, in verse 18. And then, it says at the end of verse 18, rather, in the hand of the priest is to be the water of bitterness that causes a curse. Okay? So there's a curse coming if this woman is indeed being dishonest and has indeed had an affair. If not, all is going to be good, and we'll see how this works. Okay, verse 19 and 20, read that.
And the priest shall put her under oath and say to the woman, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not gone astray to uncleanness while under your husband's authority, be free from this bitter water that brings a curse.
All right, so if you're all good, there's no curse coming, but if you have, there is a curse, okay? 20, we see a bit of a description. In 21, actually, we see that. Keep reading, Will, in 20, and we'll see kind of what that curse will be.
But if you have gone astray while under your husband's authority, and if you have defiled yourself in some man other than your husband and has lain with you, then the priest shall put the woman under the oath of the curse, shall say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people. When the people make you, when the Lord makes your thigh rot and your belly swell.
Okay, so here's the curse, okay? Mine says your thigh wastes away and your abdomen swell. Okay, that is the curse. So we need to figure out what the heck does that mean, right? This water that brings a curse shall go into your stomach, make your abdomen swell, in verse 22, and the woman shall say, amen, amen. So that's the process that they would go through, okay? 24, he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness of the curse so that the water may which brings a curse, will cause this bitterness. So that's the idea of what the curse would be. Now, verse 28, if the woman is okay and there's no sin in her, if the woman has not defiled herself and is clean, she will be free to conceive children. Okay? This is the law, verse 29, of jealousy, being under the authority of her husband and goes astray to herself, the spirit of jealousy that comes over and kind of the end of it all. Okay? So based on what we see here, what would you guess is the curse of this woman?
Barrenness.
Yeah, probably barrenness. That's what it seems. We don't know exactly what the effects were, but it looks like if she slept with another man and is impregnated by that man, what happens to that baby? It seems like God forces a miscarriage. Her abdomen swells, meaning she looks to be pregnant, but she's not. So something happens in the midst of that. Potentially, she's just made barren. Okay, so I don't know if that's exactly the case or what, and commentators aren't exactly sure. But it's clear that in that day and age, if she stepped out of the authority of her husband and God's covenant relationship of husband and wife, she is no longer able to bear children, okay, as a curse of her decision. Now, if she's all good, then it's great, and she's fine, and the priest would kind of roll this magic eight ball. I mean, it's kind of an odd situation, but if she's proven to be clean in this matter and not have sin, she's free to bear children, meaning her womb is open, okay? So it's an odd text, and that's the procedure that would go down. I would hate to be hanging out with my wife after that, after I've accused her of something, right? And, oh, sorry, you're all good. Like, I think there's going to be a little bit of marital tension afterwards, right? That's going to be an odd deal. But this was based on their proximity, their living quarters, whatever. God inserts this rule to say, hey, just to make sure there's none of this going on, maybe to heighten the penalty for stepping outside of the bonds of marriage, which already was death, right? So I'm not sure what else you can do aside from that, but this was the thing that God brings. So there's chapter 5. Thoughts on that?
Very one-sided.
It is very one-sided. I knew one of you would say that. I thought it would be you. Actually, I thought it would be a girl. It is kind of one-sided, yeah? So you don't say anything for the guy. There's no curse for the woman to say, hey, you know what? I think my husband slept with that girl. It's not in the text. Why would that not be the case?
The men are all faithful.
Clearly. We are not a bunch of scumbags. We know that's not the case. Other options. You guys are terrible. Seriously, though, why would a woman not be able to? It's not because of lack of opportunity or lack of sin or that guys are any better. I mean, we know that. What's this speaking to? Ladies, we talked about it on Wednesday. It's about order, right? That's the idea. The woman is coming out from underneath the established headship of her husband, and if that's the case, then the husband has that right and that role to do that, okay? It's not that a husband that does that is somehow uncondemned, because his penalty would be what? Death, okay? So it's not that God says, oh, no, it's okay for him to do it. It's just not okay for you to do it. That's not the case, but for whatever reason, this is how God sets up this plan, okay? It does feel, I agree with you, a little bit one-sided, but I think in the idea of headship and order, that's how God had it administrated.
So I'm confused about the curse, because if she ends up getting cursed and her abdomen swells, right, and she's barren, then, like, according to this, wouldn't that prove that she committed adultery? So then wouldn't she have to die so that barrenness doesn't even matter?
Yeah, it seems so based on the other stuff that we see. So it's, I don't know how that works, right? Because we clearly see the penalty for an affair is death for both parties. So maybe during this 40-year period that wasn't the curse, or wasn't this is how they dealt with it as opposed to later on. I'm not sure. So it's a great, great observation.
Could that be why the curse comes?
So you're saying, yeah, they wouldn't kill the baby in that process. Yeah. Potentially. That's a good observation. Yeah. Yeah, he could remarry. He could add another wife. So that would not be seen as wrong in the society. So potentially, yeah. So odd text. Okay, so you guys keep wrestling with that one. But to my knowledge, we never see this used in Israel, and we certainly don't see it outside of this season. So, but apparently there was a reason that God instituted it. So, okay. Now, number six, different chapter. Okay, this one's cool. The Nazirite vow. So in the midst of all these laws about packing and camping and traveling and moving and all this, we get the Nazirite vow. Okay, and you guys have studied this a little bit through, I would imagine, the book of Acts. Okay, did Shay talk about this as you rolled through chapter 21? Okay, talked about Paul taking the Nazirite vow. We're completing his vow. God calling him to fulfill the final portion of other young men who had also taken the vow. And Paul had to basically write the check for other folks that had completed their vow. That's kind of the picture of what we're getting here. Okay, who do we see, by the way, take the Nazirite vow in Old Testament times? Any names come to mind? Samuel took one. Samson took one. I think those are the two that we know of. I want to say there's one more. Maybe it was Paul. So anyway, here it is. Did you guys study this text when you guys were in Acts? Okay, let's go here. Let's talk about this idea of the Nazirite vow. Okay, this is above and beyond type of deal. Okay, kind of like the Leviticus 27 vow, where we like, hey, you want to go above and beyond and take this vow? It's not required, but here's something you can do. Okay, this one seems to be even more specific than the Leviticus 27 piece. So 6:1, let's pick up there. Oh, all right, stop right there, Jacob. Thanks. So man or woman can take this vow, and it's a special vow. Same word we saw in Leviticus 27. It's a plea, extraordinary, big. It's translated, again, many different ways, but the idea is it is a big deal, a special vow above and beyond commitment, okay? Now we're going to see God institute. If someone takes this vow, they have to do a certain list of things, and we'll see those start in verse 3. Jacob, keep rolling.
He shall separate himself from wine and strong drink.
Okay, so no wine, no alcoholic beverages. Okay, what else?
He shall drink no vinegar.
Okay, that seems like that would be really easy to me. Okay, vinegar makes me want to vomit. When I grew up, curse my grandmother. She would make my mom wash the kitchen floor, right, and wash everything in their house with vinegar and water, okay? So, like, that smell, ugh, makes me nauseous. Well, every time I got in trouble, I had to wash the kitchen floor on my hands and knees with a rag. We did not believe in mops in our household, with vinegar and water, like hot vinegar. That's, my mom said that's what works the best, and that came from my grandmother. So, loved her, but literally, today I cannot smell that smell without getting nauseous. So, my dad would, like, once in a blue moon, we'd get like Long John Silver's at our house, and he would dump that vinegar stuff on his fish. That's nasty. So anyway, don't y'all do that. That's sin. It's in Leviticus. It's under the, it's in 11 through 15 about food you can't eat. Just trust me, it's there. Okay. So no strong drink, no vinegar, which is weird, but whatever. Okay. What else?
And shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes fresh or dry.
Okay. So no grapes, nothing from the vine. Okay. Keep going. Okay.
All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head until the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord, and shall be holy.
Okay, so what else in verse 5? What can't you get?
He shall let
haircut. No haircuts, okay? So some of you look funnier than others, right? But you can't cut your hair for the entire duration of this vow, okay? Notice what else? 6 and 7. Keep reading, Jacob. So what else can't you do? No dead people. Not even a funeral of your mom or dad. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Even Aaron, the high priest, is allowed to take like a PTO day and go to his parents' funeral or his brother's funeral, right? That's given in the law. But if you took this vow, it don't matter if it's your wife. Like, you're staying at home with your afro and, you know, and your glass of Kool-Aid because you can't drink wine, right? You're staying home. You cannot go see the funeral and mourn appropriately, okay? So no wine, nothing from the grape, no haircut, Nothing dead, okay? So that's beast, that's animal, that's whatever, that's family member. So, I mean, we'll see that obviously as we get with Samson, and he sticks his hand in the carcass of a dead lion, right? That's a direct violation of the Nazarite vow. So that's the Nazarite vow, okay? Those are at least the tenets of what you can and can't do, okay? Why would God say, by the way, maybe no haircut? What would that signify? Why would that be something he would include in that list? Exactly. You think people around you would know that you were taking a Nazarite vow? Like you're showing kind of an external commitment to this thing? Rob Bell, before he became a flaming heretic, in case you want to know my opinion on Rob Bell, that's it. Did I say that sensitively enough? He did a sermon on the Nazarite vow at Willow Creek Community Church in Chicago years ago. It was actually really good. But he, in typical Rob Bell fashion, like teaches why he's doing something on stage that's illustrative as to what he's talking about. So he brings this guy up on stage, this redheaded kid that had the sweetest afro you've ever seen, right? I mean, like gigantic, like Ronald McDonald afro. It was awesome. And he's talking about this idea of the Nazarite vow. And while he's doing it, he's talking about what it would mean to complete the Nazarite vow. And he shaves this guy's head on stage during a sermon. I'm like, who does that? So... anyway, it was a powerful sermon because you got to see, gosh, how long did it take to grow his hair like that? And this poor guy, he probably called a year ago and said, hey, I need you to start growing out your hair. Why? Well, just grow out your hair and trust me. And then you go to Chicago with me and we're going to go teach. So anyway, that was hilarious, but you got to see the picture of it. Okay. So you would, excuse me, set yourself apart for some duration of time. Okay. And you had to do all of these things. Okay. Now, let's see. At the completion of that, verse 8, you just see all of his days of separation are to be holy to the Lord. So if you get to pick kind of the duration of this. We see different durations in other external kind of extra biblical sources. We see people that took Nazarite vows from like weeks to even upwards of multiple years, 7 years and beyond, that they would be set apart for the Lord for this purpose, okay? Now, verse 9, read here what happens if you accidentally defile yourself in the midst of this vow.
And if any man dies very suddenly beside him and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing.
Okay, what does that mean? Why would you have to shave your head? You're going to start over. Oh, dang it. So if you accidentally became unclean, which... do you think that would be difficult, right, when you're living with your brothers and sisters, mom, dad, extended family in a house, you know, in about 450 square feet inside a tent with 10 people? You think people would die sometimes in their sleep or things like that? How hard would it be, by the way, to avoid wine? In that culture, wine's everywhere. Wine's all the time, okay? It's a normative part of upbringing, okay? I had a buddy that I grew up with whose parents' philosophy was, look, if we expose our kid to alcohol early, it won't be this big mystery, right? So if we sit at the table and he's 14 and he wants to have a glass of wine, let him have a glass of wine, right? Because it hopefully would not create this big sense of, oh, when I'm older, I'm going to sneak it and whatever. Now, my buddy was an absolute nightmare, so it totally backfired on his parents. But logically, it made some sense to me at the time, or I at least thought his parents were really cool when I was in high school. But... that's the idea. This was a normative practice. So these were things that would have been somewhat difficult to avoid, minus the vinegar thing. I think that would have been easy. But the wine, the death, like that's a normal part of their everyday life, right?
With like the dietary requirements and then also without touching their body, I have heard that like some people, it's like you have to become a vegetarian because you can't touch a carcass.
I think prepared meat's okay. But you would have to have been like extra sensitive. They're certainly not preparing it, right? How about birthdays? How about bar mitzvahs? How about celebrations? Like you're the guy sitting in the corner like, sorry, I can't have anything, right? You know, you couldn't enter in. So like there's even a sense of like you're somewhat awkward within the midst of the community that you live in. You can't enter into these celebrations the way that maybe everybody else is. Hey, we're going to toast, man. You know, hey, Mike's 40 and old and, you know, whatever. Like that's... You can't participate. So this is kind of a big deal that you're asking yourself to be restrained in those ways. That's the idea. Okay. So what's that?
Was there a length of the vow or was it for life?
It's determined by, yes, there was a length, but it was determined by the offerer. So We see, again, I think in my sources, where is it? 30 days. We have evidence of people who did this for 30 days, upwards of 7 years. There's actually a, Rob Bell mentioned in his sermon, someone that had recorded in the Mishnah or the Talmud or some whatever source, someone were like 6 years into their vow and defiled themselves and had to start over. Can you imagine? Like, that's, sorry, buddy. It's going to be a long 6 years, right? So, but it's completely done. Verse 12, you see it. Dedicate to the Lord as a Nazarite. He shall bring a male lamb, a year old for a guilt offering, but the former days shall be void because of his separation. So you had to offer certain things if you became defiled, hit the reset button, start over, and do it again, okay? Now, assuming you finish this vow, and some of them, by the way, could be for life. We see Samson seems to be for life. Paul's was for a duration. So they're all over the map, okay? When you finish your vow, verse 14, look at this laundry list of stuff you had to do and what you had to bring. Someone start in verse 13.
Now, this is the law for the Nazarite when the period of his separation is over. He is to be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and there he is to present his offering to the Lord, a year-old male lamb without defect for a burnt offering.
Okay, lamb. Second lamb.
A ram without defect for a fellowship offering.
A ram.
Together with a grain offering.
A grain offering.
And a drink offering.
Drink offering.
And a basket of bread made without yeast.
And a partridge in a pear tree. Okay. how much do you think that cost? Two lambs, a ram, all this like mixed fruit and vegetables or whatever for the grain offering. This is expensive. So do you think a normal guy like Will's like, oh, I'm going to take a Nazarite vow, and I'm ready to complete it. You think you got the funds in your bank account to complete this vow? What do you think is going on behind the scenes with that? How are you going to complete your vow, Will? You're broke, right? You're working your 9 to 5 and doing the best you can, but you don't have that kind of fundage. It's a community thing. So as you enter into this vow, who do you think you're bringing alongside of you? Your community. So you're saying, here's why I'm doing this. This is what I intend to do. Here's the duration. Will you support me in this? And by the way, when I come to finish it, I'm going to come call on my life group, and I'm going to ask you to pony up a lamb, right? And a ram and a goat and, you know, frankincense and myrrh and, you know, three wise men and so on. I'm going to need to lean on you guys to help me fulfill this vow, right? You get an idea of Paul had to write the check for, was it two or three dudes in Acts 21 that were finishing their vow? And that was his evidence of showing the Jews that he wasn't abandoning the law. So he's like, done, right? Here you go. I'm Jewish. So I believe, you know, that was his proof positive that he wasn't punting the Jewish faith. So that would have been a big deal, okay? Now, the odd thing about this text is, what do we not see regarding the Nazarite vow? What question are you guys asking right now? What's it for? Why the heck does someone take this vow? Okay, it's not in the text. Speculate for me. What do you think would cause someone to say, man, I've lived life, I'm in Jewish community, right? I'm enjoying all those aspects, but I'm going to set myself apart publicly in front of people because I'm going to grow out my hair, a man or a woman, right? I'm going to abstain from all these things that frankly are fun and part of society and life every day. I'm going to intentionally abstain from those for 30 days, half a year, a year, 7 years, for the purpose of why?
For Paul, he did it with like the Corinthian church, or when he was in Corinth.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe that's a great observation, especially with the church in Corinth and what was going on there, trying to right the ship in that church that was pretty jacked. So maybe to come alongside of them and focus on God for a season, okay? I think it's certainly a good observation. There's not a right answer here, by the way. I don't know. I don't have some mystery answer for you that I'm about to drop on you. I have a speculation. What else? What would cause you guys to want to do something like this.
Well,
yeah, Bree.
Would it be so you're not falling into just like the next religious, like, I guess, rotation of things? Like, if you're sacrificing, then there has to be a heart change there, and we're then more reliant on the Lord.
Yeah. Quite possibly, right? Like, when our religious day-to-day life costs us nothing, like, there's no sacrifice involved, like, how hard is it to walk with God, right? So maybe there's a sense of, man, I need to ramp up the difficulty here to understand what I'm committing to so that I don't get stuck in this rut.
Like, during that time, would they be considered more holy, like, than the regular people or the
Not necessarily. They certainly would have stood out. There certainly would have been a sense of like, wow, that guy's or that gal is, they're doing something crazy. I'm not willing to do that. You know, so there would have been that sense, but I don't think there would have been a sense of like, they're better than me or closer to God than I am.
One of the main things that is part of the Nazarite vow is giving up alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm. Maybe unpack that some more. Okay. Struggles with
addiction.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Put it on your list, right? Rob Bell makes the observation, and again, he's a heretic, so I hate to quote him. Sorry, you don't know what I think. He makes the suggestion that possibly it's individuals that had long-term besetting sins, struggles that they had, that they felt like, man, I cannot beat this. And for whatever reason, they thought, you know what? I'm going to commit myself to a season of denial, a season of focusing on God, getting my mind and my heart right, and I'm going to enter fully into this vow. And I'm going to deny myself things that I would normally enjoy, like community with my brothers and sisters in Christ, alcohol with, you know, parties and dinner and festivals and Passover. You couldn't participate in those things, right? Because that's part of life. So he made the observation. I think it's a fair one. I wouldn't take a bullet for it, but maybe it was for people that were just at that place in their life, okay? We don't know for sure. I doubt that was Paul as to why he took a Nazarite vow. I don't know. Paul talks about a thorn in his flesh, and I wonder if Paul had a maybe a sin issue that he had to wrestle with that kept him humble. Maybe it was a physical abnormality. There's been many suggestions as to what that was. Samson was kind of forced to take a Nazarite vow, and he obviously didn't give a rip about his vow. So he didn't have the heart behind what this vow talks about. But we see kind of that picture. So maybe, I don't know, but I think it's a fair, maybe safe observation as to why someone would go above and beyond and sacrifice that degree to deny themselves, right? It's kind of like fasting, right? It reminds us that, look, I don't live, as Jesus said, on bread and water alone, but every word that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. So maybe to deny my body something that it rightly needs and is good for it reminds me of what is really the most important in my life, right? So if you guys have never fasted, that is a fascinating experience. It's a very godly experience. And I've got friends that have done them for like long-term fasts. We had to do it for seminary for 24 hours. 24 hours. I mean, it's hard. I mean, when you're like, donuts. Oh, I can't eat donuts. Oh, I hate fasting, right? You know, but it reminds you, why am I fasting? Why am I doing this? Am I just doing it to not eat? Like, am I trying to lose weight? It's like, no, I'm denying my body its fleshly desires so that I can focus on the things of God. And you realize how many times you think about food and just the simple needs of your body, and every time you think about that, it's a denial of, you know what, no, God is far more important than that. So it's a fascinating concept if you guys have never done it, and a very biblical one. So if you've never fasted, talk to someone before you do that knows how to. But it is it's a great exercise for our faith to go through if you've never done it. Okay, so for what it's worth. So again, we don't get the why. God doesn't give us the why. It was assumed in the culture that they knew the why. So when you all get to heaven, say, hey, can someone explain, you know, number six that was there, right? What's going on here? Okay, they'll know better than me. But I think those are some cool observations, okay? And I think the part of it that's awesome is that the community's involved in that. Can you imagine if it is one of those besetting sins and you're confessing to your community, this is why I'm entering into this vow? and you're having to confess to everyone around you. And at the completion of it, I need you and you and you and you to all write a $1,000 check for a ram and to this and to that and some, son, do you think they're hoping you don't screw up and start this over or, you know, accidentally drink wine or whatever it may be? So anyway, fascinating picture, okay? Now, end of chapter 6, rather, verses 24 and following. Here's a prayer that you've heard before. It's mentioned at the completion of the Nazirite vow. I don't know if it is in conjunction with it. It's not just limited to saying it at the completion of a Nazirite ceremony, but this is one that you've heard before. It's beautiful. Pick up in 6:22. You guys heard that before? That's the Aaronic blessing, okay, that came from God to give to Aaron, and that's how he blessed the people, right? We see it on greeting cards. We see it all over the place, but that is the Aaronic blessing that was given by God, okay? It's one of the most beautiful little nuggets of a prayer that we see as to how God interacts with us and what their desire was, okay? So there you go. There's a Nazirite vow, so noodle on that some more, okay? I think this was done after the conclusion of times in the sanctuary or what have you. So I would imagine it could be mentioned there as well. But I don't know all the context for where they would say that.
What was the other one we were reading about? The Nazirite vow. It was the parent was dedicating their child or something. I thought that was the same thing as the Nazirite vow.
Yeah. In Samson? You guys are already fast forwarding. We didn't even study that stuff. You guys are brilliant.
It was saying the parent dedicates the child, and then that child can go and do the priestly things.
Keep noodle on it. I can't remember. It's not ringing a bell with me. Sorry. My memory's gone now that I'm 40, so. Chapter 7, right? We see a little bit more of This is offerings given by the leaders. This is kind of cool. So as they are instituting now, think back, obviously, back to the tabernacle. We're not that far from this thing having just been built. We've read a lot of texts from there, but there's still needs that the sanctuary needs and all this stuff and the people that are required to perform these duties, right? The Kohathites, the sons of Merari, and the Girgashites, they all have needs. And they basically tithe from the leaders of the community to meet the needs of the people, okay? I like this because it's the leaders that have to go first, okay? Pick up in 7:1.
When Moses finished setting up the tabernacle, he anointed it and consecrated it and all its furnishings. He also anointed and consecrated the altar and all its utensils. Then the leaders of Israel and the heads of the families who were the tribal leaders in charge of those who were counted made offerings. They brought as their gifts before the Lord 6 covered carts and 12 oxen, an ox from each leader and a cart from every two.
Okay, so the leaders bring carts and covered things and all this stuff. Why would the leaders of the tribes bring covered carts and oxen, two for the leaders and oxen? Why would that be their offering? Any idea? Let's keep reading, okay? Moses took the carts in verse 6 and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. The 2 carts and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon according to their service. 4 carts and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari. What were their jobs? You guys remember? Those are the two of the families underneath the Levites. Yeah, they had to carry all the heavy stuff in the tabernacle. How do they carry it? On these. The leader said, hey, you have a need. As the religious leaders of the day, those that were they're servicing us and taking care of us, we're going to tithe from what we have as the leadership and give you oxen and give you carts so that you can take that all those poles that are used to set up the tabernacle and not have to huck them over your shoulders. You can put them on the cart now. That's cool. Okay. Now, Gershon and Merari both got these, but verse 9, he did not give any to the sons of Kohath. Okay, because theirs was the service of the holy objects, which they carried on their shoulder. So these guys, remember that. Could the Kohathites take the ark out of the tabernacle and drop it on a cart and transport it that way? No. Okay, remember that. We're going to see it in 2 Samuel 6 when a guy says, hey, I got a better way to carry the cart. This is dumb, and this is heavy, and I got a, you know, blister on my shoulder, right? This is not good, okay? So that's going to come back to haunt him. But it's the leaders that go first. The rest of chapter 7 is a daily account of every tribe leader that comes and says, and here's my offering. Well, yeah, and here's my offering. And they give lavishly, they give sacrificially. It's really cool. So every day, each tribe would come, each of the 12 tribes that gave, right? There's 13 tribes. Levi didn't give. They would come present their offering before the Lord. And chapter 7 is all about what they did, all the way to chapter verse 89, okay? So really cool that they went first, right? That's a great example of leadership. There's a need. We have the ability to meet it. God has blessed us. Let's bestow that on the others, okay? So that's the picture of chapter 7, okay? Chapter 8, we get a little bit more description of the priests and what they're to do. Look at just kind of some random verses. Pick up an 8:5.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the Levites from among the children of Israel and cleanse them ceremonially. Thus you shall do to them, to cleansing them, sprinkle water of purification on them, and let them shave all their body, and let them wash their clothes, and make themselves clean.
It's an odd text, right? So if you were in the law we saw yesterday, what were you not supposed to cut? Remember the side growth of your beard? What were the Levites called to do? Take a razor over your entire body, right? So I'm a cyclist. I shave my legs. It's biblical. See, all you guys are in sin with your hairy legs, okay? Shave, okay? For whatever reason, that's what they were called to do. So I don't know if they were all bald or I don't think that's the case, but there was some sense of setting apart of the Levites even amongst the Israelites, kind of above and beyond law, okay? That's the idea, okay? And they are, again, going first and being distinct, and 8 is more of, again, some of the things that the Levites specifically are to do, the pictures of, in verse 10, laying their hands on, presented to them, that people would lay their hands on them, in the setting apart of this generation. Okay, so we won't get into all of chapter 8, but it's more on the Levites and kind of that sort of thing. The finish of chapter 8 we read earlier about how old they had to be when they came into the priesthood. This is the text where we see 25 now all the way to age 50. Okay, chapter 9 is kind of a cool thing. There's a group of people that come to Moses and say, hey, we celebrated Passover, but we were unclean. We weren't allowed to celebrate Passover, but our heart is to celebrate Passover. What do? We abstain because we were unclean, and that was the right thing to do, but our heart desires to enter into fellowship with my fellow family and believers and with God. What do we do? So it's a great question, and it sparked actually from a really good heart. In verse 6, they were unclean because of a dead person, so they could not observe the Passover. So they had touched a dead person, a family member had died or whatever, so it was nothing that they had done. It wasn't because of sin. It was just natural life consequences, but they were unclean during Passover. And Moses says, you know what? Verse 8, wait, I will listen to what the Lord commanded, okay, what the Lord says concerning you. So let me go talk to God, and let's see what he says about the issue. Is the law always hard and fast, or is it made to breathe and to move and have life at certain times, okay? Verse 10, here's what God says regarding this issue.
Speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any one of you, if any one of you or prosperity is unclean because of a corpse or is far away on a journey, he may still keep the Lord's Passover on the 14th day of the second month at twilight. They may keep it. They shall eat it. They shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs.
So what does God say? Can they still have Passover? Absolutely. When? The second month, the 14th day. When was Passover again? You guys remember? First month, 14th day. So a month later, y'all can celebrate Passover. Hey, maybe you were on a distant journey. Maybe you were doing a job that required you to be out of town. Maybe you had defiled yourself because you touched a dead person. Okay? It happens. No worry. So what does God say? Can't have Passover because you missed the day? No, the law is made to be flexible and to breathe. The spirit of the law, if you will, is seen here where God says, that's fine. So we'll do it a month later, and you guys can now enter in and celebrate God. So beautiful picture of God's heart, even in the midst of this, okay? But verse 13, if you're thinking, you know what? I just don't want to get out of bed today. I'm not going to celebrate Passover. I'll just do it a month later because it's really inconvenient for me right now. God says, no. But if the man who is clean, verse 13, is not on a journey, and yet neglects to observe the Passover, that person shall be cut off from his people. So this isn't a whatever's more convenient for you. This is a case of, listen, you're unclean or you are physically unable to be here because you're in, you know, another place. Then you can do that, okay? So just a cool picture of when we see the law, God's heart through the law, we already see with Nadab and Abihu and Aaron and his lack of fulfilling all the details of a certain offering and not eating a portion of the offering because his heart wasn't right. God says, that makes sense. I like that. Heart before fulfilling religious external duty, okay? Hey, you can't fulfill your duty and celebrate Passover because of something. Okay, but your heart wants to. Can you do it a month later? Absolutely no problem, okay? So I love seeing God's heart behind the law and how I think we're supposed to see it, okay? So that's the idea. Rest of verse 9, we kind of see just a description of how God would interact with them at the camp. Remember, in chapter 10, we're about to see the Israelites move for the very first time. They've been at Mount Sinai now for a year, and they have not moved since Exodus chapter 19, okay? Verse 16, so it was continuously that the cloud would cover it by day and the appearance of fire by night. So that is where how God, again, represented himself above the tent of meeting, above the tabernacle, and how this worked. Okay, end of verse 18, as long as the cloud settled over the tabernacle, they remained camped. So, man, if the cloud's there and you wake up in the morning and there it is, then you're staying camped there for at least one more day. However, if it would move, then you would set out. Okay, verse 20, if sometimes the cloud remained a few days over the tabernacle, then great, then you stayed a few days. Okay. If sometimes 21, it remained from morning to evening, and you set up camp, and the next day it's moving, then you got to move again, okay? 22, whether it was 2 days or a month or a year, the cloud lingered over the tabernacle. You don't know how long it's going to be. That's how you camped, okay? And at the command of the Lord, they camped, and then they would move, all right? So, chapter 10 now, we're going to see him move. They've been given 10 chapters of instructions on how to move and how to stay and how to camp and all that. Now we're going to do it, okay? Chapter 10. We won't roll through again all the details of it, but the idea of how they camped is how they would move and the way it would work, okay? Verse 10 of chapter 10, read how this thing would kind of get kicked off.
Also on the day of gladness in your appointed feasts, at the beginning of your months, you shall bow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings, and they shall be a memorial for you before God. I am the Lord your God.
All right, so we see this thing that's introduced in verse 10. It's called a shofar, okay, your trumpets. And you will blow the trumpets at the beginnings of these holy days and such to mark the beginning of these things. It was also how the people would know it was time to move. So Moses would see, all right, God's on the move. He would take a shofar, which is literally a ram's horn. They have them in Israel still today. They're a great souvenir from Israel. And you would blow into your shofar, and it makes this crazy noise. And it was like a trumpet. People go, hey, something's going on. It's time to move. Okay. At that point, chapter 10, verse 11, the cloud was lifted from the tabernacle. Verse 12, the sons of Israel set out, and they would leave in order. Okay. So just notice as you look through here, verse 14, who goes first? The sons of Judah, okay, then Issachar, then Zebulun, exactly how they're camped. So they would leave in an order just like they would camp in a certain order. After they had left, in verse 17, the tabernacle was taken down. The sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari who were carrying the tabernacle set out. So they would go in. They would take all the external pieces. The rest of the tribes would come. Verse 21, the Kohathites would then come in, take the holy objects of the tabernacle after they had been covered, obviously, by Aaron and the JV priests. 22 and following, Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin in verse 24, and at the back of the guard were the sons of Dan, okay, 26, Asher, 27, Naphtali, okay, so those are the way they would camp, all right, and how they would move as they left, right? 29, this is kind of a cool aside as to kind of how they would move. Oscar, pick up there in 29 and read now Moses' interaction with his father-in-law. So this is Jethro. Why they give him another name here, I don't know. Hobab. So, I don't know. That's kind of a cool name. So, anyway. So, he's talking now to his father-in-law, Jethro.
We're setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give to you. Come with us, and we will do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to Israel. But he said to him, I will not go. I will depart to my own land and to my kindred. And he said,
all right, so, sorry, I may have confused you there. So, Reuel is the other name for Joab. Hobab is Moses' brother-in-law, okay? So, Moses is speaking to his brother-in-law, saying, hey, dude, we're about to leave. Come with us, okay? Why don't you journey with us? And what's the, why is Moses asking Hobab, his brother-in-law, to leave with them on this journey? Now, Hobab is a Midianite, right? Just like his wife Zipporah is a Midianite, just like Jethro is a Midianite. But he says, come with us. Why is he asking that? Verse 31. Dude, you're our guide. Why would he ask him to be the guide? This is your stomping grounds, right? You're from here. You know where to camp. You know where water is. Now, isn't God their leader? Isn't God going to lead them? So is it wrong to trust God and yet be wise and discerning about how you do things in life and get a guy like Hobab that can say, man, look, yeah, I actually know this area. I've shepherded sheep here my whole life. Like, I know how to travel and how to stay safe and how to take care of people in the wilderness. Anything wrong with that? It's brilliant, right? You don't lean on a shovel and pray for a hole. That's basically what God's saying. So Moses is wise enough to say, man, let's get Hobab. And Hobab says, no, I'm going to stay here. And he says, hey, no, please come with us. And we don't see his ultimate answer. It seems like he goes with them. And Moses says, man, please, you know, all the stuff in verse 31, so it will be in verse 32. If you go with us, it will come about that whatever good the Lord does for us, we will do to you. Man, God's going to take care of us, but whatever good that we're going to experience, you're going to get blessings in return. And it says, they set out from there in verse 33, a 3 days journey. So it seems like God now is having them move, and Hobab comes with them. Okay, so chapter 10 now, we see Israel move for the very first time. They're going to go now a 3 days journey, and God's going to bring them into a more difficult portion of the wilderness, okay? So they've been at Mount Sinai, probably in the south portion of the Sinai Peninsula. They've been in some tough spots, but they ain't seen nothing yet, okay? So chapter 11, we're going to see the feel and the context of what's going on change dramatically, okay? Chapter 11 through 16 kind of all fit together, and they're one big portion of Scripture, and you're going to see this issue of what is inside the Israelites begin to come out, okay? In chapter 11, I want you to see where it starts. Chapter 11, 1, pick up there. Like, okay, that's all in one verse. Like, son, okay? So what's going on in 11:1? What happens?
This is hard. I don't like this. Where's my food? Where's my...
They are barking again, right? So people start complaining, okay? In the adversity, of the adversity in the hearing of the Lord, okay? So God's answer to said problem is what? We're going to set them on fire, okay? Some who were on where? End of verse 1. Outskirts of the camp. Now, we just looked at 10 chapters as to how Israel camps, right? Very specific. Who would be on the outskirts of the camp?
The warriors.
Maybe. Is God very clear on where every Israelite tribe camps? Yes, they have a designated spot. Who does not have a designated spot? The rebellious who came out of Egypt with Israel? non-Israelites. Where do they camp? On the outside of the camp. They don't have an assigned, you know, lot number when they pull up and say, that's your campground. Camp there. They don't have one of those. They were the folks that were on the outside. Okay, they are described in verse 4 as the rabble. Okay, so why would the grumbling start with them, the people on the outside of the camp? Why did they come? For what? I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. You're still sticking with it. Yeah, I have 2 ears, but they only work one at a time. Max, say something good that I can understand.
I was saying they were provided for, and God provided for them, and that's what they wanted.
Yeah, okay, so they provided. How so? What did God do to show his provision to the Egyptians as to why they go, yeah, I think I'm going to go with you guys?
He took care of them when Egypt was plagued.
Okay, through the plagues, right? They got to see God's miraculous hand at work, okay? The vending machine God, remember that? Your God's awesome. He's displaying power. Your God wins. He's taking, right? So cool. Now where are they? They're in the middle of freaking nowhere. They're hungry. They're tired. They need water. And where's your awesome God? Crickets. He's not here. This stinks. And that's what they're saying. So they start barking about the situation. And God says, oh, yeah? You came because you think that you pull my string and I do whatever you want me to do. That's not how this works. So he consumes a portion of the people on the outside of the camp. Okay. Very strong lesson. Now, for those of you guys that know anything about complaining, what does complaining always breed? A little bit of complaining with a few people always does more complaining. Okay, and we're going to see what happens as these people on the outside of the camp start barking about, hey, do you remember what it was like back in Egypt? Do you remember how we used to sit next to pots of meat and eat and enjoy life? And it was wonderful when we were slaves. And so they start complaining about this. Okay, God consumes them. Verse 4, the rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and the sons of Israel wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? So God, again, has ramped up the difficulty in their life. He's brought them specifically to a place where they don't have necessarily what they want. They've been eating manna now for a year, and banana, is getting old, and they are tired of it, okay? So they come to Moses. They bark at him. Moses in verse 10 hears the grumbling of the people, and then Moses goes to God. Look at verse 11, and I want you to see how Moses feels about this at this point in his leadership career. 10 or 11, verse 11.
So Moses said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all these people on me?
How does it feel to Moses leading all these people? A burden, right? You guys ever felt that leadership burden? I listen to Brad often as just a friend talk about what it means to be, for lack of a better word, he didn't say it like this, and he never would, but to be at the top of the food chain at the well, to understand budget, and I have 60-some-odd staff. Most of those staff have spouses and kids, and we have to provide enough money through Tide to make sure these people get paid. To make sure that they can pay their mortgage and they can pay for their kids, you know, shoes and that sort of thing. And that becomes a burden. It's a weight. Man, I just come to the well. I go to my box on the 1st and the 15th, and, oh, hey, there's my paycheck. Awesome. I didn't think about how the money got there. I was never worried about tithe. I didn't think about any of those things, right? I didn't think about, man, I wonder if Chris Schultz is getting paid today, or Eric is, or Janelle. Like, it never crossed my mind. But as a elder and as a senior leader, you think about that. There is a burden side of leadership that only those in that position understand. And as soon as I began to lead a nonprofit on a much smaller scale and now have employees that I care about, and I want to make sure that they're okay and that we can pay them, and, you know, employees that are having babies and need insurance and things like that, it's like, man, this is a lot of responsibility. And there's days that, man, it'd be easier just to go work at McDonald's as a single guy and flip burgers, and, you know, I can go sleep underneath the park bench if I have to, but now I have responsibilities, and now I have obligations to other people, and I intend to keep those. Moses feels a bit of that. Lord, I am obligated to feed these people, to water these people, to move them around the wilderness, and when something goes wrong, who do they yell at? Do they yell at God? They never yell at God. Who do they yell at? Moses. This is your fault. And he's beginning to feel the weight of that leadership, right? Moses is a good leader because he cares about that, right? He feels that burden of, God, I genuinely care for these people. And we see that over and over and over again. But it's getting heavy. And when these people become unappreciative and difficult and complain, there's that tension of, man, you have no idea what I'm doing behind the scenes to provide for you guys and do the best that I can. And all you do is bark about what you don't have. That gets old. So Moses says, Lord, this is hard. Verse 12, keep going.
Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing child?
I mean, is that not a beautiful picture? It's like, you ever seen a mama puppy or a mama that's got like 20 puppies on her that are all trying to fight to feed off of her? Good night. You see that poor mother that's like, oh gosh, right? That's how Moses feels. Like, I got 3 million babies that are all trying to feed off me, right? That's that. It's just a, it's a beautiful, it's a hard picture of like, this is how Moses feels about these people. Okay, keep going.
To the land which you swore to their fathers, where am I to get the get meat to give to these people for the, they weep all over me saying, give us meat that they, that we may eat.
Right? They're constant. Where do I get meat? I can't get meat. I can't do this. That's what they want, right? Verse 14. This is, gosh, 14 and 15. Keep reading.
I am not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. If you treat me like this, please kill me here and now. If I have found favor in your sight, do not let me see my wretchedness.
Wow. Where is Moses at emotionally at this point? God, just kill me now. Can we just be done with this? I don't want to spend another 40 years leading these people through the desert. We're 1 year into this. At this point, they're, I forget what it is. It's like 37 and a half years left that they have, right, between the journey out and whatever. He's got, man, they haven't even, they're a fraction of their way into this journey. And Moses is so spent with these people. He's like, God, just take my life. I cannot handle this if this is how it's going to be. So it's gone from a burden to burdensome, and he feels like he cannot do his job, so kill me, okay? Now, he makes the observation, and we've seen this as a kind of a core struggle with Moses. Number one, where am I to get meat to eat? Like, Moses, you know better than that. It isn't your job. It's God's job. Secondly, I alone am not able to carry the burden of this people. What have we already seen with Moses and his tendency with his leadership strategy, if you will? Take it all myself, right? I'll be the martyr. I'll do it all, right? And what does God say about that? What did Jethro say to him? Moses, you're an idiot. You're going to burn out, right? You're going to burn out. And what else? You're going to burn your people out. You remember, that's what Jethro said. Get people to help you. And I don't know if Moses has or what, but God's now going to say, okay, in regards to that, verse 16. So what is basically God's command? 70 men. What does that mean? I can't do this alone. Go get 70 men. Go get a team, right? Go get a bunch of people that can help you. Okay. God basically says they are in verse 17, end of verse 17, shall bear the burden of the people with you. They're going to help, Moses. You need help. Okay. Verse 18, after Moses does this, or in 17 rather, sorry, 18, God says, after you've done this, I'm going to help you. Say to the people in 18, consecrate yourselves tomorrow, for you're going to have meat. You want meat? I'll give you some meat. Here you go. And this barking that you hear in 18, oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt. We're going to quench that right now, right? They're barking about how good the days were in Egypt. And God says in verse 19, you want meat? Here you go. Not for a day, not for two, not for five, not for 20. You're going to eat it for a whole month, verse 20, until it comes out of your nostrils. Like, wow. You think this is what you want? Okay, here you go. You guys ever seen the movie? It's old, but it's really good. With Richard Pryor, it's called The Toy. Is it The Toy? Or is it Brewster's Millions? Dang it. Is it The Toy? Okay. I can't remember what I saw it as a kid. Anyway, it's a fascinating picture of this guy who thinks he wants to be rich, and he's given all this money. He basically has a ton of money. He has to spend all of it and have nothing left but the shirt on his back by the end of the process. He has to spend all this stuff, and he thinks that money's ultimately going to bring him Brewster's Million. Thank you. Toy something else, which is equally funny. Anyway, but that's the idea, right? So they think, man, what we want is meat, and if we give him meat, God says, great, we're gonna put that to the test. You think this is what's going to make you happy? I'm going to give you so much of it that it's literally going to come out of your nostrils, right? I had a buddy that went through residency, like, I think it was like year two. Great guy. When he was a kid, he snuck into his grandmother's purse and took a package of cigarettes out, right? Brand new pack of cigarettes. And he and his buddy decided they really wanted to smoke a cigarette. So they were, you know, like young teenagers, 14 or whatever. So they went into this closet, right, and smoked a couple cigarettes each. And then they realized, oh, crud, there's 20 in here, and we both smoked two. We should probably smoke the rest of the pack so my grandmother won't figure out that we smoked them all. Okay, he's a great guy. He's just not a smart guy, okay? So they stayed in the closet, and they smoked the entire pack of cigarettes, like in a coat closet, right? Like, really? So he smokes all of them. His grandmother never finds out. Because then they threw the package of cigarettes away, which why that didn't occur to them to do that in the first place, I don't know. Anyway, he said that was problem solved, though. They thought they wanted cigarettes. They each smoked 10 apiece. Now they didn't want cigarettes. He said, I have a problem smoking ever again after that. So anyway, funny story. But that's the idea. God's like, here you go. We're going to bring it out of your nostrils. So this is how we're going to deliver to you the meat that you think you want. Okay? 21, Moses said, man, Lord, why did we leave Egypt? That's what the people are barking about. Pick up in verse 21. What's Moses saying? God, this is not possible. Like, did you not see God provide food in the wilderness, water out of a rock? Like, Moses, hello? Of course it's not possible. That's how God works. So he's bringing you to the end of possible so that he can show up and show you what he can do. Okay? Beautiful picture. And God's kind of, he's gracious. Okay? Verse 23, the Lord said to Moses, is it that the Lord's power is limited? Moses, really? Like, do you think that I can't do this? Now you shall see whether my word will come true or not. Moses, I'm going to demonstrate for you in your lack of faith that I can indeed do this. Okay? So that's the idea. Skip down to verse 31, and let's watch how God provides this this meat for the people. All right, stop right there. So God provides quail, literally, that would have been migrating like over the Mediterranean Sea in that deal, and brings a wind to push them all into the middle of the Sinai Desert. Like, that does not happen. They were all flying 3 feet off the ground, so you just grab them. I guess you'd cook them first. But you know what I mean? Like, there's plenty of quail. And whether they're 3 feet off the ground or they're stacked 3 feet high, there's debate on what that means. But it's like, man, nobody gathered less than 10 omers full. An omer is like... oh, it's like a liter and then some. So it's like plenty. They had a gigantic buffet of meat, exactly what they wanted, okay? Now, verse 33, while they're eating, while they're gorging themselves at the buffet table.
While the meat was still between their teeth and before it could be consumed, the anger of the Lord burned against the people, and he struck them with a severe plague.
Some sort of plague is given on these people, potentially death, potentially some sort of disease, but it's a rebuke to the people for saying, number one, you don't think I can provide this. Number two, you're barking about how days were so much better in Egypt, and you ate pots of meat and were slaves, and how you've completely lost perspective, but you're not trusting me for my provision, right? So in chapter now 11, you see the barking of the rabble. What are you seeing happen now in chapter 12, or chapter 11, rather? Who's barking now?
The
Anna, you got the right idea. No? What's that? Well, who starts the barking at 11? Where has it begun to move from? To the people. Now it's in Israel. Now it's not just the rabble barking. It's coming inward. Okay? Chapter 12, verse 1. Watch who's barking now.
Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife, for he had married a Cushite.
Okay, so Miriam and Aaron, specifically in that order, come to Moses with said issue. We have a problem with this woman you have married. Whether this is Zipporah, who was a, potentially could have been the Cushite woman they're speaking of, or Zipporah's died and he's married now another foreign woman, okay, looks different, speaks different potentially. They bring this issue. What we find out very quickly is this is not the issue. This is the issue they bring. There's something else beneath the surface that's really driving now their complaining, okay? Verse 2, here is the real issue.
Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? They asked, hasn't he also spoken through us? And the Lord heard this.
Ooh, what's the real issue here? There's jealousy of what? So God's using you, but what was Miriam's job? Remember when they crossed the Red Sea? She's rocking the tambourine, right, leading worship. She's up front, everybody singing, spotlights on her. She's in leadership. Where's she been for the last year? I don't know. Nowhere. She's not, like, mentioned in the text. So, like, her role is now reserved. Moses has now exalted 70 other men that all had the Spirit placed upon them. That was the rest, by the way, of chapter 11. God gives the Spirit to all these other leaders. And Miriam's like, hey, what the heck? I'm your older sister. Like, I've had a really sweet job in Israel. Is God speaking only through you? And they bring it up to this false, like, Moses, we need to talk about this woman that you've married. When in reality, it's this selfish desire to lead. Where did that come from? Where did that barking originate? With the rabble. And it started outside the camp, and now it's crept in, and now Miriam and Aaron are barking about their rights and their role and what God's not doing through them. Do you see how this disease is festering inside the camp? By the way, it ain't done, and it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. But these two start barking in chapter 12, verse 1, bring up the issue, and then Moses in verse 3 writes this about himself, which I always think is kind of odd. So this is where you have to believe that Scripture is inspired and written by God as well as man.
Now Moses was very humble, was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else in the face of the earth.
Like, how do you write that about yourself? I am so humble. In fact, humble more than all of you. Anyway, Spirit-driven, right? So I think that's probably inserted later by maybe Joshua or what have you. That's the belief. So I don't think Moses wrote that about himself. But, okay, now, verse 4, send it at the end of verse 2. God hears this. Verse 4, now God responds. Okay, now make an observation. 12 verse 1, Miriam and Aaron come and bark against Moses. Verse 5, now God says, Aaron and Miriam come forward. What changed? The wording. Why? Aaron's the leader. Hey, you kind of like it when you get to be the guy in Numbers 5 that says, hey, I think my wife's having an affair, blah, 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 blah. Miriam and Aaron go before the Lord. It seems like Miriam maybe is the one barking, but what does God say? Oh, no. Aaron, you're going to take responsibility. I'm calling you out. Now, they're both going to get kind of smacked around a little bit, but God places him first as if to say, no, this is on you. You should be leading better. Miriam obviously knows better as well, but they had now come forward, and God says, boy, in verse 6, y'all are ding-dongs, and you should know better. Okay, hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak to him in a dream. How did God speak to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph? Dreams, right? They would interpret them and they would see God move that way. Not so, verse 7, with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. When I speak with him, I speak mouth to mouth. Openly, not in dark sayings, and he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? You know the relationship I have with him. Shame on you. This is your brother, and you know the uniqueness of how I communicate with him. Not like anyone else I've ever communicated with in history, nor will I in the future. You should have been fearful to say what you're saying. Now, the anger of the Lord, verse 19, burned against them, and he departed. So he drops this pretty strong rebuke. Verse 10, watch what happens as now the Lord is exiting the scene.
When the cloud lifted from above the tent, there stood Miriam, leprous like snow.
Whoops, leprous as snow. Okay, we've seen leprosy. Did I talk a little bit about what leprosy is and the significance of it? Talked a bit about that. Why would Miriam be given leprosy specifically? Why this as her punishment? Physically, what happens to you when you're leprous? Yeah, skin falls off. You lose sensitivity in the extremities of your body as they begin to literally kind of rot, right? So they say a leper can literally stick their hand on a stove, can't feel it. So they will inflict pain upon themselves often because they just don't know they're doing it. They can't feel it. So one of the things that a leper yearns for is the ability to feel again, okay? Relate that to what's going on with Miriam spiritually, that God would give her this disease as an audio visual of what's going on inside of her. Are you tracking with me? What's happening internally with Miriam spiritually between her and God, her and Moses? She's lost that ability to feel and to sense and perceive the Lord, I think, and that's why God gives this one. We're going to see God give a king in Israel the same disease, and it is a screaming lesson of, I am giving you a disease that represents itself by the lack of ability to feel physically because you have lost the ability to feel spiritually. You don't sense my movement. You do not know what's going on. You should know better. So God gives her leprosy, and they are shut up inside the camp now for days. Now, watch who comes to save the day in verse 11.
Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy, and he said to Moses, please, my Lord, do not hold against us the sin that we have foolishly committed.
Now, notice Aaron's language, we, right? So, okay, yeah, I did go first. We've committed this. He didn't get leprosy for whatever reason, but he sees his own sin in this.
Do not let her be like stillborn. Moses cried out to the Lord, O God, please help heal her. And the Lord replied to Moses, if her father had spit in her face, would she not have been in disgrace for 7 days? Confine her outside the camp for 7 days. After that, she may be brought back.
The idea here is in verse 14. If she had disrespected her father, and her father spit in her face as a result of her disrespect, would she not be shut up outside the camp for at least 7 days? If she disrespected her earthly father, how much more her heavenly father in the way she's disrespected me in my leadership. So she shut up outside the camp for 7 days. She ultimately gets healed, but the Israel is now stuck watching Miriam outside the camp knowing they can't move until the consequences of her sin are dealt with. Okay, so it's a bit of an embarrassment to Miriam and Aaron, and you don't see them barking anymore throughout this text. Okay, so chapter 13 and on we'll get to in 2 weeks when we're back from Thanksgiving break. But remember, we're kind of where we're at in the midst of this difficulty and what's happening here. But we're seeing this issue of complaining continue to move into the center of the camp, and God is going to deal with it in a very swift and harsh way in the chapters to come. All right? Guys, have a great Thanksgiving. Enjoy your week off. Have fun working on your Acts charts. Okay? Be thankful.